Hello, I'm here. Yaroslav Klopot, Joint Institute for Nuclear Research, Dubna. I have two questions. The first, I wonder, how do experimentalists extract baryon density in ion collisions? And is it possible to do it for a single particular event?
Yeah, once you ask me a question and I wouldn't answer it, this time I'll answer it.
Should I repeat?
You asked me how you compute the
baryon density in ion collisions, and is it possible to do it for a particular event, for a single particular event?
A particular event? Yeah, it might be, yes. So the answer is, I'll try to get the slide. You do the particle-antiparticle ratio, but the most interesting one is P to P bar. So there's a nice simple formula for the ratio. And further details with the difference, they sometimes do. Oh, they do it with the strangeness and they do it with other things. But I think the baryon chemical potential is just from... There's some bad slide. It goes in the same place. There must be some bad slide. No, it's my fault. It's not his fault. Yeah. No, this is, I thought I had fixed it, but I'll be there in a minute. Here it is. One more slide. Bah, bah, bah. I'll go back to this one. So the simple answer is you do the P bar over P ratio. And if I can find that slide, and that gives you the baryon chemical potential. It's like e to the minus 2 p bar over, I'll be with you in a minute. What's the other question?
The second one? The second one is about spin.
Here it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's how you do the baryon chemical potential. You measure the p-bar over p-ratio and you compare it to the Boltzmann equation. And that's the way you do it. So here you know what T is.
Yeah, I see, but how do you do it experimentally? I mean, you call it...
Well, experimentally, you measure the p-bar over p-ratio.
No, no, but in order to measure the density, you need like... volume, and you need
No, it's pretty straight. You mean to measure the P bar over P ratio? It's pretty straightforward. Most detectors can do it.
And if any heavy ions.
In heavy ions, yeah, we all do it.
The same, yeah.
The point is, both detectors, both Phoenix and Star, have time of flight, and we have precision time of flight, so we can separate. We measure the momentum. And our experiment has a time count of 5 meters from the origin. So we have 100 picosecond resolution. We can separate protons out to maybe 5 JeV. So we can do P bar over P ratio all the way out in high PT and at low also. So we measure the whole spectrum, and then you just need the number of protons divided by the number of antiprotons. It's pretty straightforward, and STAR does the same thing.
Okay, thank you. And the second question concerns spin program
at
BNL. Could you please expand more on that, because you was quite short. And in particular, what should be measured to solve the proton spin puzzle?
Yeah, I can do that. I can do that. Let me go to the end here. See if I can get through without. So the point is, we measure. See how I define. Come on. I don't know what it is. Well, for instance, here's an example of what we really wanted to do here. So, for instance, this is for W, which is a special case, because the W, we measure a parity, what we're going to do here is measure a parity violating asymmetry. So, for instance, we make a W, and the way you define a W is by detecting the electron of the muon, okay? So you detect the electron of the muon at some angle, theta, and some rapidity, eta. Okay, well, that's... actually, you can't quite do it. If you actually do it with the muons, you can actually find x1 and x2 for that event, because if the muon gets far forward enough, there's an ambiguity. Where does the neutrino go? W goes to E mu. And if the muon is far enough forward, energy conservation shows you that it has to be coming at you. So you can actually find, for forward Ws, you can actually find x1 and x2. And then if you look at this formula, so what you measure and you get some answer for ALW plus at x1 and x2. So here, for instance, if x1 is much greater than x2, meaning it's moving very far forward, then this AL of the W directly measures delta U over U. Delta is the difference. If you have the proton is polarized that way, it's how many quarks are polarized this way compared to how many quarks are polarized that way. So that's how you do it with the W, and so far I can say we haven't succeeded, but in principle, that's the way you do it. Now with other particles, say, for direct photons, I think you can do it also. Okay, so this is what we predicted when we started, and we didn't get there yet. So we can always measure at a given X, if we make a W at rest, we know what X1 and X2 are, W is at rest. We use what I call the Zucchini signature. You see 40 GeV electrons coming out, and W is at rest. You see a Jacobian peak. Actually, I have pictures of it, but the next slide. Oh, we're in luck. Here. There's a measurement. Okay? So here's a Phoenix measurement. It says preliminary. I actually finished it. This is exactly what Zucchini predicted, 1964. That's a long time ago. And there it is. So by knowing this, we know we have the W. And we know for this reaction, the W is at rest because we can see this peak at its half its mass. So we know X1 and X2, and then we know AL. And therefore, we can, in principle, put it right on this plot. Okay, because we know X1 and X2, X is MW over the square root of whatever, the square root of S, here at 0.16, I think. So you could get that. We don't plot it that way, but you could actually get delta U over U. But in principle, that's the way you do it. In practice, what we do is we measure AL or ALL, and then you get some answer, and then the theorists run it in their parton, what do you call it, PDFs, parton distribution function. The theorists are the ones who calculate it for you. But basically, the better that you measure ALL or AL, the theorists can then show what you had. So that's that plot I showed earlier, but I'm not going to go click, click, click. Because from all the data that we had where we measured ALL in pi zero production and ALL in jet production, the theorists then can calculate what it is and then what the net spin is of the.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Lucas Farnas from the University of Wuppertal. So you showed this evidence for the phase here. This showed the evidence for the phase transition by means of finite size scaling. So I come from the lattice, and there you put a system in a finite box and vary the box size to do finite size scaling. So how can you vary the volume to do that?
Oh, so the answer is I know how to vary the volume. The answer is that you can either, I think you can either vary the solid angle, the phi distribution. So the question is always, when you make this measurement, The theorists do it, I don't know what kind of a box they do it, but they do it for all particles and all everything. There's no dimension in the problem except the volume they use. I don't know what that means, but the volume of the quark and plasma. Now what we do is we measure in a pseudo-rapidity distribution. So for instance, Phoenix measures plus or minus 0.35. That's about plus or minus 40 degrees from 90, and star measures plus or minus 0.5. I think that is 45 in eta. So that doesn't get all the particles because that's one unit of eta, but the particles are spread over maybe 4 units of eta. So we only measure 1/4 of the particles. We could move that, make that bigger. And also in azimuth, we only measure half the azimuth and they measure more. So the question is, what is the size volume that we can use to compare to the theory? Okay, and the answer is, we tried 2 and we're comparing to the theory. I actually know how to, and the problem is, what's difficult is in eta there are correlations which I didn't show. So, in fact, you just can't expand the volume. I have a slide that's confusing, but in fact, there's a certain case where you can show that it doesn't depend on the eta. Unfortunately, the data that we measure don't support that case. So that's the answer. I mean, I think it's empirical. We won't be able to do it much. I don't think we can do much beyond plus or minus a half, maybe plus or minus 1, but the whole multiplicity is larger. So I think it's empirical. You do it, the theorist work, then do it, the theorist work, and finally, that's the way you do it. It's empirical.
Okay, thank you.
Kovalenko. I have a question. When you compare your results on fluctuations, cumulants, and so on, with theoretical models with lattice QCD, how do you deal with this following problem? Your fluctuations can depend on experimental acceptance.
Yes.
And it can depend on the transverse momentum region when you cut your lower transverse momentum. How to proceed with this problem?
Well, I'll tell you what we actually did. First of all, we did a test. Since we have a two-arm spectrometer, we measured the multiplicity in one arm. So solid angle is pi over 2. We did the measurement, same eta, same pi over 2. And we got the ratio of the cumulants. Then we did the whole spectrometer. So we went from pi over 2 to pi. And we got the same answer. Okay? So that's the way you do it. Now, I know a way to get, I can tell you the way to do it in azimuth. No, I should say in eta. If this mu over k in this formula, so for instance, if you look at this formula here, so if as I take a bigger and bigger eta range, mu over k remains constant, okay, which could happen, then in fact it doesn't depend on the eta range. So that may be what saves the theory. But again, we do it empirically. I think that's one of the open questions. How big do we have to measure all the particles that are produced? Can we measure a sample of the particles that are produced? Okay, and we don't know. The answer is so far it looks good, but star has a bigger acceptance than we do. It'll only be answered empirically. Just try. But I can tell you, in this formula, if mu over k remains constant, it doesn't depend on the solid angle.
And the same is for PT, for transverse momentum. I mean the lower PT, which is 0.3 GeV or 0.8.
Well, I have to say, I think the measurement up to 0.8 is about half the particles, okay? That's why we measure from 0.3 to 2. So the issue is, you asked a good question. So here's a result I absolutely don't believe. All right? Am I going the right way? This one. So what they did, what star did here, you might believe it. here they took they measure from 0.3 to 0.8 here, and here they then open it up to 0.4 to, well, I guess 0.4 to 0.8. Here they open it up to 0.4 to 2, and it drops. It drops, but it's not, you know, you can imagine the true answer is somewhere here. Maybe we could figure that out by making different cuts. Now, offhand, I don't know what fraction. They don't show you the distributions. I mean, they write these papers, referees approve them, and you just can't go one step more to find out what they did. I think it's terrible. I mean, when we used to write papers, and we did this at the ISR, we made a measure of a cross-section. The whole, you know, pi zero cross-section from 0.5 to 12 GeV in bins of 0.1. All the points are in the paper. Anybody can take them, do fits, do what they want. Nowadays, people do cartoons. They make this, they show, oh, look at here, I made this plot. This point used to be here. So the answer is trial and error. This point, that was what the point was before. Minus 10 plus or minus 7. I'm confused. This is what the point was. Right, this is kappa sigma squared. It was 0.7 with a small number, right? That's from PT of 0.4 to 0.8. Now they go to 2. And instead of being, what did I say, 0.4 to 0.8, it's now 3 plus or minus whatever. Now, there's no way in the world that I could figure out how that could happen except one way. They're mismeasuring the momentum, so the proton spectrum in PT doesn't look like a nice spectrum. It does that, which means they're making a mistake. But unless they show all the cards, namely show the distributions, I can't figure out what they have done. And maybe they can't either. So it's just a matter of doing the experiment, doing it right. And you know what fraction? It's easy. I have to say, I don't remember what fraction of the particles are above 2 GeV, but I would guess it's a percent. So once you get 90, 99% of the particles, I think will be enough. But in this case, I don't know. I can't tell you. For us, I'm sure we get 90, at least in the PT, we get 99% of the particles. In rapidity, we only get maybe a third.
There are still quite a few questions, so maybe some questions and answers a bit.
Sure, whatever.
Because.
I can.
Maxis Kovalenko.
You can limit my time to how long I can speak. Who? Oh, how about that?
No. Oh, Puccio.
Maximiliano Puccio from University of Torino. I have a question about the critical point observation.
Yes.
Yeah. Are there any other possible measurement that can confirm this observation or any idea of any other...
I'll tell you the conventional idea. The conventional idea is, in fact, let me look at my data. Here's the conventional idea. If you... can you turn the light off? So the big thing we argue about is... do you see anything that's non-monotonic? So you think if there's a critical point, all of a sudden so these things are proportional to the correlation length to some power. Well, the correlation length is I know, I think it's like point less than a Fermi, less than a femtometer here at Rick. In eta, it's like 0.1 in eta if you use eta measurements. So now if we hit the critical point, that's supposed to diverge, okay? It's supposed to, and if it diverges, then suppose it diverged here, this point would shoot up, okay? So everybody is looking for non-monotonic points, you know, something that goes, or like that point that we saw on the plot that I said I didn't like, where it went woo, way up there all of a sudden. So that's the way you find a critical point, non-monotonicity in these cumulant ratios, and especially something that might go to infinity.
Thanks.
Vanitsky?
You already partially answered my question. And anyway, so you say that how to find critical endpoint in the Heaviside collision. However, critical endpoint and criticality are essential properties of infinite system. So I'm interested in how to evaluate effects of finite size of the system under consideration.
The answer is not my problem, it's the theory's problem. So this is to be learned. I mean, after all, the quark gluon plasma that they're dealing with is anything but finite sized. It's maybe 5 Fermi, 5 femtometer, 10 femtometer this way, 3 times longer that way, and it lasts for 10^-23 seconds. So to think about it as solid state material is a stretch, but so, you know, you do reasoning by analogy. Maybe we find, so the trick is to find an effect. I mean, if we really found, you know, like that, we'd be asking a different question. So we don't know what the answer is. It may not be, even if there's a critical point, we might not find it. We don't know. It's empirical. So the theorists have their own super models, and it works pretty well. And
but anyway, could you at least say what is an average volume of the system at the moment of its decay?
How big is it?
Yeah.
I said, it's like the radius is not more than 10 femtometers around, and the length is not more than 3 times that. And it only lives for 10^-23 seconds. So.
Okay, thank you.
And Tsukiki is going to hit a proton in that.
Savitsky? Oh, yeah.
Well, Nikola Savitsky, Desi Hamburg. I wasn't so fast enough to get understanding about this nice slide with ripples from the particle separating wave from the primordial plasma. So basically, what was actually the evidence of this effect in the measurement? Was there some kind of periodical changes in the dynamics of the quark gluon plasma or what?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand a word you said.
Okay, I will repeat. So basically I'm asking about this effect, about ripples from the particle separating wave from the primordial plasma. So what was the evidence of this effect? I couldn't understand it.
Of
this effect.
The one that I showed, you mean?
Yes. I mean, was there some kind of periodical changes in the dynamics of the quark gluon plasma or
no,
what?
Well, we don't know. That's what we think. Well, I shouldn't say we think. It's controversial. Let me tell you, it's controversial, okay? Did I get there yet? Oh, good. I can go home now. But let me show it to you. Here. So here are the measurements. So you make these measurements of the two particle correlations, and you can see they're very nice measurements, okay? Very well behaved. Then you just plot them. So here are these two, the difference in the radii are out, namely when it's coming out at you and our side when it's going, you know, when the particles are unbalanced like that, that's out. When the particles are unbalanced. When the particles are unbalanced like this at side, so you make that measurement, and what we see is the only measurement that we've seen at the Rick energy range, and I'd say this goes all the way down from 10 GeV up to 2.7 TeV. It's the only measurement we've seen where it's non-monotonic, right? It goes up, and then it goes down. So somewhere here, that's the only evidence we have. And then, as you see, if you look at the slides, my good chemist friend knows how to then fit these peaks of the particles to this function and the peak position to that function and the peak value to this function and then get some coefficients. But basically the only data that we have is this. This is the radius, the difference in the R out minus R side radii as a function of root S for different centralities. That's the only evidence we have. And you look for bumps. It's like, how do you find a resonance? How do you find the J psi? You're looking at lepton pairs, and all of a sudden, cross section goes up by 1,000. I don't think we'll be that lucky, but you know, it's much tougher to find something in this thing than certainly measurements with real solids.
Thanks.
Carl?
I'm here. Hello.
Okay.
So my question is regarding, is there any measurement which gives an idea of the contribution of the gluons to the proton spin?
Ah, for spin you mean, or what?
Yes, to
all
the
right.
proton spin.
Let's go back there.
The measurement has already been made?
Yeah. Am I going back? How do I go? Am I going backwards or forwards? It's going to crash again, so. Oh. But then I'll be in the right spot. Maybe it doesn't crash going backwards. No, I'm going the wrong way. I'm crazy. Sorry. I guess it's almost time for dinner, but I'll answer your question. As long as nobody leaves the room. So we're definitely in the so how do we know? Well, we know the physics, actually. Oh, it works well this way, huh? We know the physics of, it's quantum chromodynamics, where two gentlemen in this room helped invent it. Some of the formulas are really excellent. Here it is. So what this is a measurement. We're always measuring at mid-rapidity, 90 degrees scattering. All right. So here is a measure of the pi zeros. And what we measure, you have polarized protons. And look at the, so XT is essentially, this is completely gluon dominated because we're at low X. So if you look at the QCD predictions, low X, it's gluon dominated, and high X, it's quark dominated, in the middle it's something else. But these are definitely, XT is 0.1, the maximum one here. So here's your completely gluon dominated region. And the same with the jets. The jets are in the same region. And so we measure, and we hardly see anything, but you actually see there is an effect. This ALL is not zero. It goes up. And then the theorists then calculate their structure functions, and it's dominated by the gluon PDF. And same with the jet. So once they do that, now I would rather be able to do it myself. In other words, aha, you know, plot X and calculate it, but we unfortunately can't. So then here are all the theorists' calculations, and this is now their calculation of the best fit to their gluon G of X, the gluon polarized distribution. So that's their best fit. And here the error is quite good, okay? But you still don't get the integral here of the gluons is what did I say? It's only 0.2. So 0.2. I remember I said the quark's integral is 0.17. So you're only up to here. There, so you haven't explained the spin of the proton, which is half. Now, if their prediction is correct, in other words, if this, that's what they get for their errors, maybe one sigma. So if their prediction is correct, then in fact this solves the spin problem, if that's the true answer. But we won't know until we improve the measurements to low X here. The lower X. Now, lower X, it sounds easy, but it isn't, because you lose the hard scattering, so you have to go up in momentum to do it, in CM momentum. Okay. But if we can do that, then we can... So, if, for instance, if we got this error down here by a factor of 3, then that's the end of the proton spin problem. It's cool.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. And Lee, last question.
Here, I'm Kali from Shandong University and IHAP. And I have a question in your page 39. Page 39, please.
39, okay.
Yes,
let's
39.
Let's see if I can get there without breaking the... He's in there. 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38.
Ta-da! Yes. Yeah. So
I didn't show this, so he read my slides, huh?
Yeah, I read your slides.
Yeah, okay.
So all the error bars are dominated by systematic error.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes, so if we remove all the error bars, we can see the shape. But the shape is not consistent with a flat line. All the shapes, I mean. It's not consistent.
Well, what happens is we measure multiplicity distribution, okay?
Yes. And so I mean, your conclusion is that it works well. For example, in left plot, it works well below 62 to 200 GeV.
Yeah.
But if we look at the shape, it's not consistent.
Yeah, actually, what happens is it works above. Well, here is the best one, but it also works well
yes.
here too. What are these triangles? So 62 works at 62. And below 62, it fails, right?
Yes, but I mean...
I know it works at 30, by the way, but...
So in 200 G, for example, in 200 G, where the shape is not consistent with
the flat line.
It's
just the way it's plotted. It's consistent because these are, what do you call it? They're all correlated systematic errors.
Yes. So
I can move them all down. And if I plotted it a different way, you'd see it's consistent.
But okay. Your statistical error is so small, right? So the shape can be determined very well.
Well, yeah, I have to say, so ignore these white points here for a minute. But these three fit it very nicely, and these don't. Okay? But, I mean, if this happens to be one plot that I showed. If you plot it as a fit to the multiplicity distribution, mm-hmm. It simply doesn't fit. I don't have one handy, but I'll be happy to talk to you in private.
Okay. Thanks.
Unless there's an urgent question.
Yep.
Coming
back to the critical fluctuations, which you discussed around page 86, could you show this?
Let's see if I get there. Oh, you mean the ones with the... Yeah, okay, I'll get there.
It works
when I do it slowly or when I use my...
Yes. These are the formula, but you showed the series of plot in...
Oh, yeah, well, I'll get to 86, yeah. I think.
You're the good. Last. Before.
Yeah. Before we all get hungry, 79, 80, 81. I can even count, by the way. I can even count the binary. All right. This. You mean the next one or this one?
I didn't mean this. But you showed the functions... go a little further.
This? Or...
Not the formula, the series of plots in net baryon number.
Oh, net baryon number.
Yes.
All right, let's go back. Just stop me when you see it.
Yes, this transformation. This I meant, exactly. Now, I can, if at some particular mu b or equivalent, there is a critical fluctuation. I do not understand how you can get a series of curves like the ones you show. Up there.
I'll tell you a
Nothing fluctuates.
I'll tell you a joke.
Okay. Yes.
And you'll know my answer. What's green, hangs on the wall, and whistles? The answer is a herring. So you're going to say, herring isn't green. So you paint it green. Then you say, herring doesn't hang on the wall. So you hang it on the wall. Then you say, a herring doesn't whistle, and I say, okay, so it doesn't whistle. So there's no critical point. What could I tell you? We're still looking. I mean, I don't know what will happen. It's very possible that when we do this at, when we have 62.4 and 39, maybe when we do it at 49, it'll look a little pointed. So we have to just make the, we're shooting in the dark, we have to make the measurements. But it may not, there very well may not be a critical point.
I predicted them.
You predicted a critical point?
Yeah.
Where? I'll see you later, okay. Okay. You put it in an envelope and we'll open it up when we get the prize.
So much for critical points. Okay, then I'd like to thank Professor Tannenbaum for his lecture.